This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, segregated communities are common in Illinois. We'll discuss the problem and some possible solutions. We'll visit the State House and find out more about a lobbyist often referred to as the Church Lady. And we'll take a look at the Thompson Center State Office Building in Chicago. The state has talked about selling it. We'll hear why some want it to go, while others are fighting to save it. And we have the story of the Radium Girls. They worked at factories, including one in Ottawa, Illinois, where they were exposed to radiation. They became sick and died.
The Radium Girls story is a cautionary tale that if we don't always make sure that workers' rights and safety are regulated and protected, that this could happen again.
Those stories and more coming up on this episode of Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll learn about a state government lobbyist, often referred to as the Church Lady. We'll remember the story of the Radium Girls, and we'll let you know where you can see portions of the Berlin Wall on display in Illinois. Later, what to do about segregation in many Illinois towns. That and more coming up on Statewide. First this week, the James R. Thompson Center in Chicago's Loop is a lot of things. You can get a driver's license and do other government business, and it's also where over 2,200 state employees work. Illinois is getting closer to selling the Thompson Center. State officials say the building needs about $300 million in repairs. Preservationists say the Thompson Center is a postmodern gem worth saving. Carrie Shepard with WBEZ digs into the history and the problems of the Thompson Center.
Jonathan Solomon has a deep appreciation for the Thompson Center's architecture.
And it's distinguished by this curving reflective glass facade and a 160-foot diameter public atrium on the inside.
Solomon is one of the founders of the James R. Thompson Center Historical Society. The group is leading lunchtime tours of architect Helmut Jahn's building.
Who is familiar with the building, sort of feels like they know something about it and its history, and great.
That prompted a variety of responses, including this one.
I want this to be my Halloween costume.
The tour moves inside and goes down the escalator to the atrium, or as most people know it, the food court. Solomon points to the glass cylinder straight above. The floor is more elegant than one would expect.
The pattern that we're standing on now in the central atrium is based on the Piazza del Campidoglio in Rome. And the bold color scheme is meant as a pastel take on red, white, and blue.
The James R. Thompson Center Historical Society is using the tours to focus public attention on the architecture, but they don't dispute the, quote, rough state the building is in. And the tour touches on some of the questionable engineering choices made early on, like 800,000-pound ice cubes in the basement.
There's a term for it. I'll tell you what it was.
This is Gary Skoyan. Skoyan was head of the Capital Development Board in 1985 when the State of Illinois Center, its original name, opened. CDB manages the state's construction projects.
At night, when electricity rates were low, they froze ice in huge ice banks. And then in the day, ice water was circulated in the building for cooling.
Skoyan remembers during the design process, his former boss, Governor James R. Thompson, was immediately sold on the squat open atrium concept.
Let's say there were four designs from prominent architectural firms in Chicago. Three or four of them were typical glass boxes, typical office buildings, and then there was Helmut Jahn's.
The building was named after Governor Thompson in 1993. Beyond Jahn's design, which one critic likened to a spaceship invading the loop, there were issues with infrastructure since the beginning. That ice block cooling system, it didn't really work. That's according to an Illinois Auditor General report released in 1986.
During the summer, indoor temperatures ranged in the mid to upper 80s and in some areas frequently reached into the 90s.
The report says because the air conditioning was different from conventional systems, it, quote, complicates the debugging process. In a survey of 39 state agencies working in the building back then, the top two reasons for hampered efficiency, temperature, and noise. The final budget for construction was about $172 million. Now a private developer, Skoyan says the process the state must follow creates deadlines and budgetary problems.
You have to bid out plumbing, you have to bid out electrical, and then they are basically assigned. It's a goofy system. And it,
you mean too many cooks in the kitchen?
Exactly right.
Skoyan calls decades of deferred maintenance of the building almost criminal. On the fourth floor of the building are the offices of Central Management Services, the state agency that oversees the Thompson Center. Aishe Kailajiolu is the chief operating officer.
As beautiful as it is very costly, it's very inefficient, it's very ineffective.
She says the Thompson Center costs $17 million a year to maintain. Kalaigiolu's boss, Governor J.B. Pritzker, signed a bill last April to sell the building. Kalaigiolu can rattle off a growing list of complaints she hears from her staff working at the building.
Between the smell of what's coming from the food court, the noise, it's obviously not very effective work environment.
And
the fire alarm is functional, but it doesn't meet today's code requirements.
Also,
we have active roof leaks.
Finally, more than 30 years later, the temperature is still an issue.
We actually had an incident during the summer. One of the systems was down and it was getting really hot and we had to bring in, you know, portable units to cool it down.
Those issues and more add up to $326 million, the state says. So with the future of the Thompson Center in flux, what does the person whose name is on the marquee, so to speak, have to say about it? Well, there's the former governor's artistic side.
It's hard to see something that's contributed to an important part of postmodern architecture in Chicago be threatened.
And then the diplomatic, political side.
And I'm sure Governor Pritzker has done the appropriate thing in responding to the neglect of former governors.
Currently, four companies are vying to stage the Thompson Center for the real estate market. Carrie Shepard, WBEZ News.
When radium dial watches became popular in the 1920s, the Radium Dial Company in Ottawa, Illinois, hired young women to detail them with radium-laced paint. Many ended up dead from exposure to the toxic element. In 2018, Mary Hansen talked with the writer Tara McClellan McAndrew about it. McAndrew took a look into what happened, and she shared some of the women's stories.
Peg Looney was a young girl from Ottawa, Illinois. She was one of the so-called dial painters who were trained to take the brush and dip it in the paint and then point it with their lips, thus ingesting radium. She was 17 when she started working for the Radium Dial Company. She became sick, like many of the dial painters did, and she died at the age of 24 from radium poisoning, although the company did not acknowledge that.
You talked with Peg Looney's niece, Darlene Holm, who still lives in Ottawa. Here she is talking about her aunt bringing some of the radium paint home.
Sometimes she would take her younger siblings into the bedroom that they all shared, and they would go in there in the dark, and they would paint their fingernails and their lips and their eyebrows and then laugh because they glowed in the dark.
How much did the company know at the time about what radium was doing to the women who were working in their factories, and were they ever held accountable?
According to Kate Moore's book, the Radium Dial Company in Ottawa knew the women were sick, a couple of them in particular. They had started having their own company doctors do physical examinations of the women in 1925 after some of them had become ill, and the women had tested positive for radiation, but that fact was kept from the women. Peg Looney was told by the company after she had tests by the company doctor showing that she tested positive for radiation, she was told that she was healthy. And when she collapsed at work years later from being so sick from radiation, she was taken to the company doctor's hospital. She was separated from her family. Her family was not allowed to see her in the hospital, and she died. The company was going to bury her, and the family had to intervene and say, no, we want to give her a Catholic funeral. And the company did an autopsy, agreed to have a family doctor there When the family doctor arrives for Peg Looney's autopsy, the autopsy's already been done. The family was told that she died from diphtheria and later found out that no, it was radiation poisoning.
Peg Looney's family tried to sue the company over her exposure to radium, but they couldn't find a lawyer to represent them. Several years later, another group of women who worked at the radium dial plant tried again. Who took their case?
There was a lawyer named Len Grossman from Chicago. Len Grossman Sr. was very interested in workers' rights, and he sympathized with the women and agreed to take their case, and he did so for free. The women came from very poor families. They could not afford a lawyer, and they were already paying exorbitant medical costs.
Len Grossman Jr., you got a chance to talk with him. He's also a workers' rights lawyer, or had been a workers' rights lawyer for 30 years, and he talked about his father's commitment to these families.
This case was a pinnacle of his professional accomplishment. He felt very strongly about the women, especially the Donahue family. They were strong people. They gathered together when he called them together and formed the Society of the Living Dead, which was a sort of a self-support group that they had. It was just a totally emotional involvement, from what I understand.
So what happened with that case? How did that case finally end?
It ended well. He argued before the Illinois Industrial Commission, and he won the case. In his brief, he was very melodramatic, and he talked about one of them, Catherine Donahue, and described her illnesses. He said, "Rigors, fevers, and terror worse than the Chamber of Horrors have dimmed her life. What of her necrotic, crumpled jawbone, spongy, moth-eaten, typical of radium poisoning, her wasted, shrunken body, 71 pounds, her radioactive malignancy of the hip, rigid, her blood and marrow bombarded by radium." Unfortunately, the company had, in essence, hidden their assets. So the amount of money was a pool of money that was available. There wasn't a lot for the women. So while the women won, it was in some ways a shallow victory. And of course, they died. For the families that did win, at least it helped pay for some of the just horrible medical expenses the women had incurred.
Why is this story about women who died these horrific deaths decades ago important for people to know now?
I asked that question of Kate Moore, the author of Radium Girls, and of Leonard Grossman Jr., the son of the man who represented the dial painters in Ottawa, and both basically said the same thing, that the Radium Girls story is a cautionary tale, that if we don't always make sure that workers' rights and safety are regulated and protected, that this could happen again.
That's Tara McClellan McAndrew, who wrote about the Radium Girls in Ottawa, Illinois. You can read her article. We have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. As we commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down, did you know there are two locations in Illinois where portions of the wall are on public display? One of those is at a Transit Authority station in Chicago, the other in a peace garden at Eureka College in Woodford County, which happens to be Ronald Reagan's alma mater. I spoke with Shelley Schwanke. She's director of the Ronald Reagan Society at the college, and with the school's president, Jamel Wright, who tells us how the piece of the wall came to Eureka.
Back in 2000, the Ronald W. Reagan Peace Garden was being created. A professor of ours, Dr. Junius Rodriguez, reached out to the Republic of Germany and requested a piece of the wall. Peace came over naturally aboard a ship and arrived here. It took several months to get here. And I remember distinctly it arriving on a forklift and coming right across our lawn onto the campus. And shortly thereafter, it was planted right there in the Peace Garden. Interestingly enough, the crate that it came in, the lid was salvaged, and our art department art professor went ahead and had her students decorate it with some barbed wire. And it's really a neat multimedia piece that we have hanging.
Shelley, you work at a small college there. Last I saw, Eureka had about 600 students. What does it mean to the school to have such a piece of history on the campus?
As an alum, it means we're very proud to have a piece of the Berlin Wall. Our students, I'm also the parent of a couple of students, and they are very, very proud. It's a symbol of freedom. It was a symbol of oppression, but now that it's down, it just represents a great moment. And we're very, very proud that we are the alma mater of Ronald Reagan and that he made that historic speech where he called for the Berlin Wall to come down.
President Wright, I would guess most, if not all, the students there on the campus weren't even alive when this took place. Do they understand the significance?
You know, we have make a concerted effort to ensure they do. It's interesting because it's not just the significance of that, but it actually aligns very well with the long history of Eureka College overall, right? From the founding of the institution in 1855 by abolitionists who were members of the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, to the history of being the first in the state and third in the nation to admit men and women equally, to having Dutch Reagan then attend Eureka College in 1928, go on to graduate in 1932 and become president of the United States, where then as president, he carried on some of the values of Eureka College through appointing Sandra Day O'Connor as the first woman on the Supreme Court, through, you know, signing into law the MLK, you know, holiday, through having that one monumental statement, an exclamation of Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. So there's a long history of Eureka College that we try and impress upon the students.
And Shelley, Ronald Reagan, like most presidents, he has a complicated legacy, but I think everyone can get, and surround and get together around this idea of what he was pushing for when he urged them to tear down the wall.
I don't think there's anyone who can argue with the result of the wall coming down. We have so many more nations that are freer since that day.
That's Shelley Schwanke, director of the Ronald Reagan Society at Eureka College, and the school's president, Jamel Wright. A ceremony is being held this week to mark the occasion of the wall coming down, but you can stop by any time and see the portion of the wall on display at Eureka College. You're listening to Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, after a long year for families in agriculture, mental health advocates have tried to encourage more of them to seek support.
People have a difficult time asking for that stuff, and I do think that comes with ag. I probably wouldn't have asked either if we had needed it at the time.
We'll hear why some say addressing stigma in rural communities means more than increasing resources. That story's on the way on Statewide. Next up, gambling has expanded throughout Illinois as the state struggles to catch up with its budget deficit. The lure of additional revenue brought support from local governments, businesses, and unions, but not everyone is a fan, as some argue it takes advantage of the vulnerable. In our Illinois Issues report, Daisy Contreras introduces us to a woman who's been fighting against state-sanctioned gambling for decades.
Anita Bedell has a nickname in the State House. People refer to her as the Church Lady, a reference to a Saturday Night Live skit. She's short, with gray hair, and an unassuming presence, but she's tough and relentless. She's fought toe-to-toe with big money interests, determined on bringing more gambling to Illinois. On the very last day of the legislative session in late May, lawmakers, lobbyists, and reporters had finally received the long-awaited gambling bill, consisting of hundreds of pages before it went up for a vote. In a packed committee room inside the Illinois State House, stakeholders presented their case to legislators. And, of course, Bedell was one of them.
We're going to give you 3 minutes each to testify in opposition, and we'll start with Anita Bedell.
Thank you. 700-page bill. We wait 3 hours, and then we get 3 minutes.
You get three
okay.
minutes. I can cut it to one.
Okay,
do you want the
I
three?
I won't, but I'm just tired like you are. Sorry.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
All right.
That's how most gambling hearings unravel for Bedell, who is almost always last to speak, testifying to lawmakers who have already made up their minds. It's almost a David and Goliath type of situation, except in her case, David rarely wins. But as you heard, she keeps her cool. Paul Black with the Illinois Great Rivers Conference of the United Methodist Church says he's never seen her angry.
There's been times I said, Anita, how in the world can you sit there and just do that. She said, I don't want them to know they're getting to me. And she, you know, she'll sit there and she'll take it.
Bedell leads a nonprofit called Illinois Church Action on Alcohol and Addiction Problems. It began as a prohibition group in the 1800s. Bedell joined in 1994, just after the state legalized riverboat gambling.
And the first thing that struck me is that no one was speaking out. The media was all about the amount of money that's going to come in, all the economic development. And so in 1992, our organization got involved in the gambling issue.
Today, gambling expansion isn't the only thing on Bedell's mind. Adults will legally be able to buy and use cannabis in January. Bedell says she traveled across the state during the summer to get local governments to ban sales.
We are getting calls from churches, from pastors, from grassroots people who are very upset at this legislation and they want to do something.
Bedell says the state should not line its pockets with money from those suffering from addiction. And she has firsthand experience seeing the struggles addiction can bring. Her views were formed as a young woman who babysat for a family with gambling addiction. At the end of her work week, they had no money left to pay her. While some might call her the church lady, Bedell's lobbying style sticks to numbers and facts, not morality.
Some of the hardcore people who didn't want to hear it, they would just roll their eyes.
That's former State Senator Mike Jacobs, a Democrat who worked on gambling legislation during his nine-year tenure. His father, State Senator Denny Jacobs, was behind the state's first casino bill in the 80s. Jacobs says Bedell's style is like citizen activism. He says gambling bills, past and present, have gone through at least minor changes in response to her work. Even among her own organization, Bedell has been a controversial figure. At first, she says, some wondered if she'd be the right person to lead the opposition.
When I first started speaking out against gambling, one of my board members said, he says, you are absolutely the wrong person for this. And then he stopped and he said, you know, that might be a good thing because they'll never expect anything to come from what you have to say.
Despite the powerful lobbying groups behind both bills, Bedell says she doesn't feel discouraged. She says she works for the people who don't have a voice in politics. Sharon Brown with Kumler Outreach Ministries in Springfield says she sees Bedell's motivation stem from a strong sense of conviction.
I think she could be very disappointed. She could be very frustrated with the issues she works on. But I think that she always remains grounded in who she's serving and why she's doing what she's doing.
Bedell says, well, the road hasn't always been easy. She's ready for what's to come.
Again, I never expected to be here this long, but I just thought, you know, the Lord put me here, He kept me here, and He keeps sending people to help.
As gambling and recreational cannabis spread through Illinois, Bedell says she's not going anywhere. I'm Daisy Contreras.
You can find out more about Anita Bedell at our website, statewideshow.com. Veterans Day is coming up on Monday. It was originally called Armistice Day and was a day to honor those who fought in the Great War, World War I. Commentator Ann Knowles tells us what she's been doing to keep alive the memory of one of the soldiers who served.
For the past several years, Veterans Day for me has been a solitary celebration. I don't participate in breakfasts, parades, nor do I even leave the farm. For me, Veterans Day has been the day I plant garlic. Having little time in the fall when I wasn't teaching or supervising FFA events, the November holiday provided the perfect opportunity to get the 300-plus cloves of garlic in the ground. You see, garlic needs the cool soil of fall to initiate germination and ensure a bumper crop the next summer. With the garden tilled and the heads of the current year's garlic divided and sorted for the plumpest, best cloves, I head to the garden, armed with a couple sticks to mark the rows, a basket of garlic, and my grandpa's garden plow. As I take the plow handles and strike out across the cool, dark soil, I reflect on the hands before me that have held this simple, worn garden tool. On Veterans Day, solitary in my garden, I think of my grandpa. My grandpa, Otis DeGarmo, was born in 1889 on a small farm in southern McDonough County near a locally infamous area called Gin Ridge. He grew up driving teams of horses in his father's fields, playing in loose hay in the mow of the barn built from trees cut on the farm, and skinny dipping in the creek that meandered through the home place. When World War I called, he answered with 2 years of service in France, but not before marrying the love of his life just days before sailing to Europe. Upon his return from the Great War, Grandma and Grandpa bought a small farm on the banks of Grindstone Creek and set up housekeeping. Grandpa worked the land with his team of Percheron draft horses, built his own barn, made Grandma a blanket chest from the walnut wood in an outhouse, and raised two children. He milked a half dozen cows by hand and sold the extra cream to buy flour and sugar and pretty material to make a new dress for his little girl. In the droughts of 1934 and 36, he cut elm trees by hand each day to feed the cows when the pasture grass burned up. He slopped hogs, cut firewood, built furniture, cured hams, and spent cold winter nights reading by the wood stove. My grandfather spent his life serving his country, his family, his land, his community, with every action, building a chest, saving the cows, raising his children, he worked to build a better future. Grandpa was a master gardener, and I believe my love of the craft comes from him. I can remember his lanky, overalled frame bent over the garden plow, making deep furrows in the poor, light timber soil that he'd amended with horse manure. Beans, ground cherries, turnips, onions, and tomatoes thrived under his watch and hoe, which he yielded like a dagger against the lamb's quarters, Jimson weeds, and button weeds that dared to peek above the soil. Grandpa died in 1968. He lived his entire life within a mile of his birthplace. He was a simple man with an eighth-grade education, a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, a veteran, father, farmer, and devoted husband. I am honored to put my hands on the same dry wooden handles, to push the old rusty plowshare into the cool fall soil, and to watch the dirt part into a straight, deep furrow as my grandpa did 100 years ago. He is my hero, and I pay my respects to my favorite veteran each November 11, by myself, with my garlic, in quiet remembrance of a life well lived. In a nation where support for our soldiers is politicized, I keep my Veterans Day as local as possible, close to my family, my land, and my heart.
That's commentator Ann Knowles, and that segment was produced at Tri-States Public Radio on the Western Illinois University campus in Macomb. Between late planting, floods, and trade turmoil, many families in agriculture are operating under an extra layer of stress this year. And as Christina Stella reports for Harvest Public Media, addressing mental health in rural communities is more complicated than just increasing resources.
In Colfax County in eastern Nebraska, Julie Krackmeyer and her students have their own way of acknowledging the chaos.
It's been a year. That's how we've been saying it. It's been a year.
Krackmeyer is Colfax's 4-H extension educator. And while 4-H is known for its summer programs, Krackmeyer actually works in schools year-round. At St. John Newman Catholic School in Clarkson, students are learning about simple machines. Krackmeyer has tried this year to make 4-H a space where students in affected areas can have some stability.
This was a traumatic event. When you're 8, 9, 10, 11, whatever age you happen to be, that can really throw you off track.
High schoolers in nearby Schuyler helped repair broken fences this year and replaced landscaping for families whose homes were damaged. Using club time for community service helped students feel connected, but getting them to open up about how they're managing emotionally has been harder, especially when phrases like mental health come into the room.
Students won't say it most of the time because it's not something they're used to even talking about or might not have ever considered to be a health that they need to be worried about.
And when it comes to getting parents to consider seeing a therapist, especially in the wake of disaster, Jackie Meyer, a counselor who practices across northeast Nebraska, sees a stigma unique to rural communities. She can recite the lines she hears by heart.
This is the way farming is. Bad things happen, and next year will be better. Everybody else has always taken care of it all these years, so I should be able to do that.
Felicia Stahlbaumer feels for families who are nervous about admitting that they are struggling, let alone seeking help. She manages Schools That Care, a school-based program that connects students, staff, and families with mental health resources in two rural school districts in north central Kansas.
People have a difficult time asking for that stuff, and I do think that comes with ag. I probably wouldn't have asked either.
When the program started a few years back, Stahlbaumer's team decided teaching staff about mental health was a good first step.
The first year, we kind of sat back and let everybody get used to the idea that we had a school social worker and went through trainings and provided them information.
The next year, more than twice as many students used the school social workers. She thinks the program works partly because students seem more comfortable working with social workers if they're not just associated with providing mental health care.
So it doesn't appear that the student is just talking to the mental health worker. If they're doing that, she's doing multiple things in the school.
The setup is similar to how integrative care works, where a counselor and a primary care physician work under the same roof. Meyer, the Nebraska counselor, is a big fan. She thinks bringing different kinds of healthcare together could help show people mental health is part of overall well-being.
Because most people, when they have any mental health issues, they're going to do this with their medical people. They never think of a mental health person. So hopefully the medical person would say, hey, you know, we've got this other person down the hallway. Would you like to go talk to her?
And because rural communities still face so much stigma, a combined office could attract more patients who otherwise wouldn't risk being seen at a therapist's office. Meyer feels the same way about telehealth, which is like video chatting a therapist.
So if I'm sitting at home looking at my computer like everybody else, nobody's going to know that I'm seeing a therapist.
Meyer knows there's no quick fix to stigma that can be cultural, but she thinks improving how people think about mental health means teaching them that everybody has it, not just those who are diagnosed with mental illnesses.
We're just scratching the surface of getting people to understand it, because they have to admit that this is normal. The mental health stuff is normal, just like the flu.
And for her, that's the beauty of small-town living, knowing and loving your neighbor enough to try for a better conversation. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
Many factors contribute to homelessness: poverty, poor health, unemployment, addiction, domestic violence, and many other things that may interact with each other. But in some cases, it's easy to pinpoint the cause and prevent it from happening. Brianna Groh has the story of how the city of Peoria created a rehousing program last year to help address the problem.
Where can tenants turn when landlords' negligence or lack of resources threatens to put them out on the streets? Speakers at a Housing Action Illinois conference in Bloomington say a partnership between the city of Peoria and the Salvation Army is one example of how communities can work to rehouse residents. Last year, the city deemed a 96-unit apartment building unfit for human habitation. The Salvation Army jumped in to help the city rehouse the 45 displaced residents. The city fined the landlord $50,000 and used the funds as seed money to launch an ongoing rehousing program. Joe Doolin, Assistant Community Development Director for the City of Peoria, says the code enforcement process can sometimes create homelessness at no fault of the tenant.
Some of the most common ones are no heat, so the furnace broke. Maybe there's a gas problem, the gas gets shut off. Water heaters, no hot water, things like that. Those are things that require us to post the property occupancy prohibited because it's no longer safe for someone to be in.
Thomas Phillip, Salvation Army Tri-County Social Services Director, says while one of the organization's main operations is its homeless shelters,
I think this program allows us to skip that step. We get them housed before they become homeless.
After releasing a request for proposals, the city selected the Salvation Army to administer the program. The city refers tenants to the Salvation Army, which then deploys its resources to rehouse them as quickly as possible, typically a few days. Since its inception, the program has overseen 5 successful rehousing cases at an average cost of $2,500 per case. Doolin says the city uses the criminal housing management fines collected from landlords to sustain the program.
The landlord is the one who ultimately caused the situation and caused us have to get these services going for the tenant. And we want to make sure they're responsible for repaying it so other taxpayers and other residents aren't responsible for that.
Phillips says without tight restrictions on how the money can be used, the program helps cover everything from application fees to moving expenses that may otherwise prevent rehousing. Bloomington Housing Authority Executive Director Jeremy Hayes says the issue isn't unique to Peoria.
We've seen this scenario where an individual is renting and the property owner sells the building, or the property owner loses that property in foreclosure. We've seen that before as well.
Hayes says officials in the city of Bloomington already approach the issue of code enforcement carefully.
I do know that they are very much aware of the impact of aggressive enforcement and just looking for compliance. That always seems to be the goal.
Doolin says for communities looking to replicate Peoria's program, a working relationship between municipalities and nonprofits is a must.
This wouldn't have been possible if we just relisted an RFP and didn't have nonprofits who trusted the city to deliver on our end or create more problems. And likewise, if the city didn't have a very trusting and positive relationship with the Salvation Army when they bid on a project like this, we'd be nervous. It takes everyone working together, regardless of what your mission is, to really improve community, improve life for your residents.
Bloomington's Home Sweet Home Ministries also engages referrals from PATH Homeless Services in a rapid rehousing program. I'm Brianna Groh.
Coming up next, segregation is prevalent in many Illinois cities. What can be done to improve the situation? Stay with us on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. We've heard about the teacher shortage in Illinois, but there's another problem in schools, and this one involves those known as paraprofessionals. We'll explain that story ahead in about 10 minutes. Earlier this year, reporters from Governing Magazine laid down a mammoth investigative report that showed some mid-sized cities in Illinois are among the most segregated in the nation. The causes are many. The cures are difficult. And as part of a series on housing issues, Charlie Schlinker with WGLT reports change would take generations, even if communities pull together to address the problem.
Most experts agree change must be incremental. Minorities make up a disproportionate share of the lower-income population in most cities. Cheryl Boswell of Peoria is a past board member of Housing Action Illinois. Boswell says to get at segregation, cities such as Peoria and Bloomington Normal should require new multi-unit developments to have an affordable housing component.
How do we move the needle forward with policy that would help when policies come in place and they do housing, that there are some set-asides or some requirements in the development that so many of those housing or units will have to be for low income.
Boswell grew up being bused from the south side of Peoria to school in an effort to desegregate schools. A generation later, Peoria schools are still very black or very white, depending on where they are. She said city infrastructure decisions affect that.
Oh, it matters 100%. One of the worst things that I believe that happened in the city of Peoria was the urban renewal that came through here in the late 60s, early 70s. It broke cultures, it tore up neighborhoods, it totally changed communities that were on the south side of Peoria.
She says revitalization to develop blighted areas must build communities and not just talk about how old the housing stock is. To do that, Boswell says Peoria has to invest in infrastructure, streets, sewers, and make it easier to develop housing, which in turn creates a property tax base.
When you look at the migration of the population out of the city, those are revenue dollars that the city lost. Somehow, we have to get revenue back into the city, and I think housing is a way to do that.
She thinks the city should find ways, in addition to tax credits, to make development easier. There's an even more macro issue that encourages segregation in Peoria, Bloomington Normal, Springfield, and any other traditionally structured city. It's zoning. Ann Hotelling directs Hope Fair Housing, which serves 30 counties in northern and north central Illinois. She says the first time we had zoning was in the 1920s, and the origin is racist.
That's the first time we started to see zoning, and it started to segregate people. It was designed to have these single family areas that would be exclusionary and exclude people of color from the communities.
Hotelling says cities can counter this now by being more inclusive in rental housing requirements to promote mixed income areas. But she says there is an economic case for broader use of the tool as well. For instance, when a municipality considers moribund, commercially zoned strip malls for redevelopment, Hotelling says rezoning for mixed use helps in a number of ways.
If you reimagine that as retail and commercial on the bottom, restaurants and the dry cleaner and the cell phone repair store and housing above, then you have the housing, but you also have a built-in market for the stores below. And you're retaining that income in the neighborhood, and you're also helping to integrate it at the same time.
In fact, that's the way a lot of cities and towns looked in the 1800s and early 1900s, and Hotelling says they could again. As cities approach redevelopment, they have to decide where to put their markers. everywhere at once or in specific areas. This is a political issue for any representative council, how to share out scarce assets. But City of Urbana grants manager Sheila Dodd says there's a case for using redevelopment incentives and funds in a concentrated area until you get results. One of her previous jobs was director of Habitat for Humanity in Champaign-Urbana. Dodd says they used money from the housing foreclosure lawsuit settlement and an Illinois Housing Development Authority grant to tear down 10 homes in a blighted 8-block square area in Urbana and build new ones. And results happen fast.
And in like a 4-year time period, we saw assessments at a minimum go up $2,000 and some even more than that. And in that older housing stock neighborhood, that's huge, you know, to see that investment go back in, families start to move back in. It's a nice mix of seniors and younger families, and they kind of help each other out.
Dodd says not only did the neighborhood stabilize, diversity increased. And with people moving in, she says it's now worth additional city resources to improve infrastructure.
They have taken a look at that neighborhood and are going to be putting in sidewalk ramps and investing in the new street overlays and sidewalk repairs that need to be done.
And Dodd points out better streets and sidewalks will, over time, improve housing values as well. Another reason to concentrate a city's redevelopment effort, Dodd says, is pure public perception as available federal and city dollars shrink.
Really, for people to feel like the city of Urbana cares and they really are investing in their community, we need to have that more concentrated area of focus as much as we can.
By focusing on a single tight geographic redevelopment area, Dodd says, it's easier for other agencies and arms of the city to coordinate efforts in that same territory, such as rehabs, social service funding, and leveraging grants. On a smaller scale, affordable housing tends to be in clusters, and those clusters can perpetuate segregation. Some people qualify for housing choice vouchers to help with rent. Those are supposed to be portable anywhere in a city. Landlords are not supposed to turn down people with vouchers because they are low income. Studies show property owners often discriminate anyway. Naperville and some other entities such as Champaign and Cook County have fair housing ordinances on top of federal rules. Ann Hotelling of Hope Fair Housing says a number of people inside and outside Naperville city government came together to take on this issue.
We at Hope Fair Housing Center were receiving complaints from people, veterans with disabilities, who were turned down from renting because they had a housing choice voucher, and were getting a response from the city that they weren't sure that their source of income ordinance included housing choice vouchers. And so there was sort of a groundswell of people not being able to access housing in Naperville.
Now, in many communities, hoteling and other housing experts say community organizing is something of a lost art. She says there is plenty of anger and motivation, but less of the careful education, coalition building, and stakeholder involvement that affect real change. It's not easy or quick work. Hotelling says in Naperville, the group pushing voucher anti-discrimination provisions did that work and even found landlords in the upscale community to lobby for the measure because they came to see vouchers as desirable.
If somebody loses their job, the housing authority picks up the rest until they get another job and they're able to contribute to the housing. And so it's a guaranteed stream of rent for the landlord.
A second reason property owners should like housing choice vouchers, Hotelling says, is that the tenants tend to be more predictable than the general public.
You know, people wait for years and years. There's not enough assistance to go around for these housing choice vouchers. People wait, and then they finally get them, and they treat it like a winning lottery ticket. They are very good tenants who follow the rules and maintain the property because they want to make sure that they can have the housing assistance as long as they need it.
She says any community needs someone to herd the cats and keep the conversations going until policy measures emerge. Bloomington, Normal, and Peoria do not have such voucher choice anti-discrimination measures in place. But Hotelling says segregation and discrimination happens at all economic levels, too. And while housing voucher choice and anti-discrimination measures might move the needle on segregation, she says residents also have to be aware of their own tendencies to self-segregate. When people go to find a house or condo or an apartment, they look partly based on the job, the commute, and the quality of the area. But Hotelling says people tend to seek out advice from people they know to help shape the search.
Your social networks, because we're segregated, our social networks are segregated. And so when you tap your social network for where you're going to live, you're already tapping into segregation and the cycle continues.
Hotelling says changing policy at the top is important, but as individuals, we can also choose to integrate our own social networks. She says if cooking, biking, knitting, or a book group is your thing, you can work to integrate those groups so that when housing decisions come up, your social network will be as diverse as the city in which you want to live. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Fears of a U.S. recession might be overstated. At least that's the message in a new report from the Illinois General Assembly's bipartisan economic forecasters. The latest report from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability points to solid job growth and consumer spending as reasons why the economy is doing fine for now. Our Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey has details on some of the numbers.
The national unemployment rate remains near its lowest level since 1969, and the report says October's job growth was solid, especially in light of the long auto workers' strike at GM. Meanwhile, in consumer spending, Illinoisans registered more than 60,000 new cars and trucks in September. Compared to last year, that's up 30%.
Despite those figures, there is still uncertainty over trade policy and a slowdown in global growth. Ultimately, the report says it's impossible to predict the precise timing of the next recession. Over the past few years, Illinois lawmakers have been trying to ease the teacher shortage. One of those plans also made it more difficult for school paraprofessionals to get licensed, Peter Medlin explains.
The beginning of the school year is always hectic. That's what Susie Chagnon tells me. She's been a paraprofessional in the DeKalb School District for around 15 years. If you're not sure who paraprofessionals are, you might know them better as instructional assistants or aides.
There's a lot of scrambling. Students have needs that need to be met, and sometimes a lot of us are doing double duty, trying to cover one schedule and then breaking away mid-class to go help another student.
Paraprofessionals also support teachers in the classroom, and they provide one-on-one support to students who need the extra help and have individual education plans or IEPs. Student needs take many shapes. They could be social, emotional, or physical. Chagnon often helps in science classes at the high school, but as she says, you have to be flexible.
You never know what's going to happen. If your student's not there that day, you might be plugged in to do something else.
Schools are often hiring these positions at the beginning of the year when it can be challenging to know the needs for the whole school year. DeKalb is fully staffed with paraprofessionals. Chagnon says they have more than 50 just at the high school, but that's not the case everywhere, and she says she's not surprised by the shortage statewide. The number of unfilled paraprofessional positions at schools across the state hovers at near 1,000. That's more than double what it was 2 years ago. Chicago's District 299 alone currently has just over 400 unfilled paraprofessional positions. Emily Fox calls it an unintended consequence. This summer, a new law ended the basic skills test requirement to help quell the teacher shortage, but it also inadvertently eliminated one of the pathways for paraprofessionals to get licensed. Fox is the director of the Educator Effectiveness Department at the Illinois State Board of Education. It oversees the preparation and licensing of educators.
We estimate that the unintended consequence potentially is preventing about 1,000 paraprofessionals from joining the field between now and the end of the calendar year.
Because when the state eliminated the basic skills test, it actually stopped accepting an array of licensing tests used by both teachers and paraprofessionals. Before, you could take the ACT Work Keys and ETS ParaPro assessment to get certified. But now the only option for paraprofessionals is to have a college degree or at least proof of a certain number of credits. Administrators at the Freeport School District can feel the effects of both of those shortages. They have 19 unfilled teaching positions and 17 for paraprofessionals. Chris Shockey is the district's director of human resources.
Actually, we had four paraeducators in the pipeline to be hired, and unfortunately, the process was not completed before the bill was signed, and so therefore, we were unable to hire them to fill vacant positions.
So, lawmakers are working on another plan during this month's veto session to repair that collateral damage. It would reinstate a competency test for paraprofessionals. As of now, there hasn't been much action on the bill, but Emily Fox at the State Board of Education is very confident that it'll pass. And if it does, she says they can start working immediately.
As soon as we receive word that the bill has been signed, if it is signed, we will do a data run of all deficient paraprofessional applications, and our staff will go through and update them and issue them if they're able to.
Aside from that particular measure, they say they're still working on how to better recruit paraprofessionals and teachers to fight the shortage. Shagnon reiterates that it's not easy work.
We're having to fulfill a lot of needs for students, both psychologically, emotionally, not just educationally. It's not as easy as you think because you're tasked with handling emotional or social needs of students that maybe years ago you wouldn't necessarily have to handle.
It's also not well-paying. For example, paraprofessionals in the DeKalb School District rarely make over $25,000 per year. And districts have expressed concern about being able to afford to maintain the staff they have now when Illinois' $15 minimum wage hike kicks in. I'm Peter Medlin.
That will wrap up this week statewide. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And a reminder, you can find all of our episodes at our website, statewideshow.com. That's also where you can reach out to us, drop us a line, let us know you're tuned in. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.